For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Welcome, everyone. Good morning. I'm very happy to have as our guest speaker this morning Jiryu Mark Richmond Beiler. Jiryu is a priest at Green Gulch Farm in north of San Francisco, part of the San Francisco Center. Jiryu was ordained by my friend Lee DeBarros and did his Shuso or head monk training under Steve Stuckey, who was here a couple years or so ago, and is training with Mel Weitzman at the Berkeley Zen Center. So Jiryu is also a native Chicagoan, so is sort of coming home, and it's thank you for taking time to come and speak with us. Jiryu has also recently started engaging in academic study of Buddhism. So thank you very much for coming, Jiryu.
Thanks so much for the invitation. And thanks for the snow, everybody. I have a 2-year-old son who has never seen snow until Christmas Day, actually. We've been trying to explain for months that we're going to Chicago and there's going to be snow. And you can look at pictures of snow and it doesn't quite convey it. You can try to describe snow, but nothing quite like getting in it. You know, is snow wet? Is it wet? Yeah. No. It's been hard to explain. Now we have a common understanding, I think, of snow. Although he seems to be experiencing it primarily as a food. And we're partly to we took it to the next level, you know, and actually just brought in a bowl of it. He was wearing his pajamas and it was not time to go out and eat snow, so we just brought him in a bowl. So it's nice to be home in that way, at home at my parents' house with 6 grown-ups and 2 little kids running around. And also nice to be at home here in the Zen Center, renouncing my family, albeit for an hour, modern-day renunciation. And to come home to this sendo and see a plaque on the wall welcoming me here. Youth will end in old age. Meetings will end in separation. Wealth will end in loss. Home sweet home, the plaque on the wall of our school. Cause for great joy, this impermanence. And great questioning too, I think. Always comes up around the new year. We have special occasion to consider ends and beginnings. And I think it's natural at this time that we think about ends and face impermanence, and then naturally the question arises, so what will I do? What will I do with my life? Another year is gone. A new year is here. What will I do? How will I live these precious days that I have? And so we have the North American ritual anyway of a New Year's resolution to kind of channel this natural reaction to impermanence. What will I resolve to do? What will I vow to do this year? We get kind of serious for a minute at the New Year and say, what do I want to do with this body and mind? Because it matters. It's not that we can keep it, but it seems like it matters. There's something at stake in human life, in what we do. So I've been thinking about Buddhism in a couple different ways, and I wanted to share some of that thinking with you today. But that first point, that point about what we do matters, seems to me, the more I think of it, like maybe the or a fundamental insight of the Buddhist tradition, that and maybe actually of spiritual life generally. You know, an immature person, as I know very well, especially being home, can't help being 16 again in a way. My mom was describing visiting her mother, you know, at 80. You know, her mother was 80, she was 50 or something, feeling 16, you know. So I feel a special closeness these weeks with my 16-year-old self, and something about that young person, a characteristic seems the sense that what I do doesn't really matter. It's not really of consequence. It's basically my life, my decisions. Other people aren't really affected. Maybe I'll have some consequence, but it doesn't really have weight. My actions don't really have weight. But growing up, I think what many of us hopefully come to feel actually the weight of our actions. And I feel that that's a mark of a mature person, actually someone who is aware that what they do matters, actually inconceivably, and profoundly affects and matters, affects everyone around them, affects in a way the whole web of being, you know, Buddhist understanding of a profound, inconceivable interconnection. Any one movement ripples inconceivably, endlessly even, throughout this web. So to say, oh, no one will notice, so not a big deal, is not a way of thinking of a mature person or of a follower of Buddhist teachings. And this understanding in Buddhism is also expressed as karma, of course. The idea that our actions actually have tremendous power to help or to harm. So the question of what will I do, you know, what am I going to do today, can become a kind of heavy question, an important question. It's not a casual question. And what will I do this year also is weighty. Our actions are our only belongings, is another teaching of the Buddha that points to this. So we may feel this particularly intensely on around January 1st. What will I do? And maybe we'll make some decisions, some firm vows and resolutions. And then there will come a corresponding time, I think around February or early March, not late January, of a kind of a troubling noticing of the failure of our intention, the failure of our resolution. I don't know the statistics, but probably Zen centers and gyms alike note the you know, the first couple weeks of January are probably high volume. I haven't seen the charts, but I wouldn't be surprised. And it's true of my life. New Year's resolution, or, you know, profound vow before the Buddha, brings forth all this energy, and then energy, given that youthful vows will end in tired old vows, it fades. The energy of it fades. And so there's this moment that is to me as interesting, if not more interesting, than the moment of stiffening of resolve, which is the noticing of the failure of past resolve. So So one wonderful response to that moment is to re-resolve, to re-vow. I had the chance to train for a little while in Japan, and at a fairly intense environment, and I had an American friend who was very sincere and very committed to his practice, really wholeheartedly involved in whatever ascetic practices he could imagine were being asked of him. Most of which weren't actually being asked of him by the teacher, but that seems common for Zen teacher to simply ask students to be themselves, and the students to hear that, to twist that into meaning that they should be someone else. Anyway, so he's very, very wholehearted, and I guess, you know, his wholeheartedness, his full steam ahead, had a crash. Because youth will end in old age. And but the cycles for him were pretty fast. His lifetimes of vows were pretty pretty quick. But he had this wonderful practice when he would notice that I've really locked myself into some kind of practice or some kind of thing I've wanted to do, and now I've failed to do it. He had this wonderful practice of, well, from now on. So often when you would see him, he would be in some kind of state of, well, from now on, this is what I'm going to do. No consideration of the thousand times before that I have vowed and failed. But from now on, I'm not going to sleep or something. From now on, this beautiful moment of practice. To me, it expresses something about what it is to vow, to re-vow, and also what it is to be human, to fail, and to get up. I think maybe by the power of this vow, you know, this time, it's going to be so strong that I'm not going to fail. Seems to misunderstand the nature of vow and the nature of human life. But to say, from the ground, using the ground to get up from the ground and say, from now on, I will. It's almost like a from now on without regard to past or future. Still, from now on, I vow. Another moment of this, a wonderful old monk practiced with me for a little while at Tassajara, Lou Hartman. No longer with us. He did a practice period that I was participating in, maybe, and he was also in his 70s or even 80s at that time. And he really expressed this kind of feeling of practice for me, meeting him on the path, and he was very kind of distressed and also certain that until now he had never been practicing. I just realized my whole life has been a total waste of time. I haven't been practicing the Buddha way. You know, this is someone who's practiced 30, 40 years, single-mindedly, a model for, you know, countless practitioners, saying, I've had it all wrong this whole time. But now I'm on... so this looking forward, noticing a failure and looking forward. What I do matters. And it's okay that it didn't quite go how I thought. I have another chance to vow to do the right to do the right thing. But I think too there's another kind of doorway or opening that this moment of failure provides, and it's for me, it's not just about then kind of stubbornly re-resolving against our nature, against the forces of all of existence that keep us from controlling our world and our own life and our own mind. I think there's another insight to be gained from this moment of failure. And another Tassajara story actually comes to mind for me of you know, I think as I think about my own life, I see a kind of swing from this kind of adolescent, nothing matters, nothing I do matters, to a kind of sickness, I think, that's not that's not unfamiliar to many kind of spiritual types, or especially religious types. And that is, what I do matters so intensely that any deviation or failure is actually devastating. It matters so much what I do and what other people do. So I remember in more practice period, Norman Fisher was the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center at the time, leading a practice period, and I was, you know, we don't eat a lot during a monastic retreat. They say that if you're a 22-year-old man, the bowls are a little small. That's my experience. So the idea is that you're getting enough food in the zendo, but there's also a lot of food kind of in the kitchen, and there's this kind of side door, back door that you can slip into and get some supplemental snacks if you have failed to be nourished by the abundant offering that was already provided to you in the zendo. So I confess, you know, this was kind of, it was weighing on me, the frequency of my visitation of this back door of my snacking. And so I, you know, in a kind of repentant way, went to the abbot and said, you know, forgive me, I have been snacking. there were two things he said that really surprised and helped me. The first thing he said was, yeah, we don't really eat enough in the zendo, do we? We don't really get enough food. Very encouraging. And the second thing he said, which maybe cut even closer to the bone for me, was, oh, so you don't have any discipline. Who cares? I have never forgotten this teaching. I cared tremendously about my own lack of discipline. But I was thinking, I think what he recognized is that I was thinking that spiritual practice, that Buddhist life, is a matter of discipline. But it's not, actually. Zen isn't about doing something that we've set up as the right thing to do. There is an aspect of discipline in our practice, but that is not the heart of our practice. There's a Zen phrase, the golden chains of discipline, which I think really captures our kind of ambivalent relationship to discipline. But fundamentally, it's just another trap. It's my power to do what I think should be done isn't and cannot be the basis of a spiritual life. So if I'm disciplined, if I'm able to control my world, my environment, myself, then I'm doing spiritual practice. And if for whatever reason, internally or externally, I'm not able to control my world and myself, then I'm failing to do spiritual practice. I don't know if that's clear, but to me it's a very important point that the practice I want to be doing can't just be a matter of my ability to control things, you know. Get to the zendo. Can I get to the zendo? Our practice is to go to the zendo. It is, you know. But if I can't go to the zendo, my failure of power to get myself to the zendo for whatever reasons, is that a spiritual failure? Is that the failure of my spiritual life? And on the other side, is my spiritual success a matter of my ability to control, you know, to get to the right practice place, you know, to have the privilege, really, and the power to do spiritual retreats or zazen. So this kind of what we do, acknowledging that what we do is very important, of primary importance to Buddhism. It's also acknowledged that we can't just choose what we're going to do and then make it happen, that that's not actually how this thing goes. So there's another layer or level of Buddhist teaching that kind of comes to the rescue here when we're faced with our inability to control the what it is, to control the circumstances, say, of our life. And that is that we can work with how we do whatever it is we do. It's not a matter of whether I'm eating sandwiches or not eating sandwiches. And say it's a matter of my mind, of my heart, of my presence. All these kind of more basic aspects of who we are that we're able to practice no matter what we're doing, actually. One of my projects at Green Gulch Farm is to co-lead a group we have at San Quentin State Prison. We have a long-standing Zen group of inmates and visitors. Free people, I suppose. We've never quite landed on what to call non-inmates. Free people doesn't fit many of us. But the teaching there, you know, this teaching that what you do matters is very clear to inmates who are in this, you know, literally locked in a situation where their actions, the choices they make, ripple right back and intensify. You know, so what I do matters. But they're also in an environment where it's very clear that they can't just control what they do. So if we just said, you know, sitting cross-legged is Zen practice, or doing retreats is, you know, since what you do matters, you have to do these things to have a spiritual life, that would not have any traction. But to say that how you do, wherever you find yourself, whatever thing you find yourself doing, you have some freedom there, some opportunity there to take care of how you're doing it. And it turns out that by taking care of how we're doing each thing, we naturally want to do good things. So there's a kind of relationship there. Something about stopping second guessing our life. Abbot Steve Stuckey, who Taigen mentioned, recently had this teaching that I really appreciated of you choose, when you're about to enter some situation, first you determine, you know, basically, is it wholesome? And if the situation is, if you kind of decide that it's wholesome, then basically, you said it slightly differently, but basically then you just do it and you stop thinking about what it is you're doing and you put your energy on how it is you're doing it. And I really feel this. I could withdraw about 99% of the energy that I put into what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? What should I do? That is such a weight for me and is so distracting in a way. When I can see that actually the real question is how am I going to do whatever it is? That's the what is one level, but it's kind of a surface level. And the question of how is much more, much closer in my mind to our practice. You know, Taigen also mentioned, so I'm doing more study now, study or sitting, you know, and what should I be doing? Once you're doing something, you just do it, and focus on how is a very important teaching for me, how I'm doing something. Give up the what. Once something is happening, it's underway. no second guessing. Just take care of how you're doing it. And then I think that if there's some unwholesomeness in that what that we're doing, really attending to the how we're doing it actually kind of irons it out. There's this relationship. So, if you're very crafty like me and always looking for ways to undermine yourself, then you notice that this how that I've just set up as closer to our practice, is equally awake, is equally subject to our ability to control. So in a way, what I'm saying, it doesn't matter what you do, but it's how you take care of your mind and your heart that matters. But to be honest, you know, when you look at it, I'm not actually in that much control of my mind and my heart either, you know? I do things in ways that I don't necessarily intend. I fail to practice mindfulness and loving kindness and present non-judgmental attention. So now am I saying that those qualities are actually the basis of my spiritual life? And if I'm succeeding at that, if I'm able to be present, if I'm able to be loving, if I'm able to have this non-judgmental, compassionate outlook no matter what's happening, then I'm a spiritual person, then I can claim some kind of spiritual practice. But that if I'm failing to do that, then I'm alienated from spiritual life. Again, I don't know if this is clear, but it's a very important question for me. What I can succeed at or fail at for me can't be the basis of spiritual life or spiritual practice. Something that I can succeed at, either what, oh, I got to the Zendo, or how, oh, I was very present in Zazen. Those both seem so subject, so fragile, so subject to the conditions. another place I was practicing, Rinzai Temple at Mount Baldy, I spent a little bit of time there, and I noticed that Zazen was terrible. I'm such a bad practitioner. I'm not present. I hate myself. Zazen, I'm no good at this. What kind of spiritual person am I? And then I had some coffee. They had very irregular caffeine dosage was a characteristic of this temple. So you wouldn't know. It was literally like you would just, you know, a couple days would go by and then suddenly someone would bring a cup of coffee. And then I noticed, you know, after I had this cup of coffee and, you know, I was there, you know. And it seemed, at the time, you know, I actually think I thought, oh, now I've regained my spiritual life. But how could this be, you know, the great way now hinges on a cup of coffee. Not that the cup of coffee doesn't matter. And not that my presence or absence in Zazen doesn't matter, but is it the basis? Am I really setting that up as the basis of my spiritual life? And again, I think Buddhism traditionally sees this problem that, and just as the how kind of comes to the rescue of those of us caught in the what we do, so the who comes to the rescue of those of us caught in how. Who is it, is the fundamental question, I think, at least of Zen and of Buddhism as a whole. Taking care of what I do, taking care of how I do it. Who is that? Who is that succeeding and failing? Who is that who had the power to get to the Zendo? And who is it who had the discipline or the power or the grace to be present in that Zendo? You know, who is it who walks and who is it who falls down? So to practice at all levels and in all ways, to me is, and I think for the tradition, is of vital importance, but that it's grounded, that it's based in this, in the kind of infallibility or the adamantine strength of who is it? There's a wonderful story that can't possibly be true of, although I kind of suspect it is, of Kobunchino Roshi. You may know if this has any historical basis. He was a great Zen teacher and also an archer, if I understand correctly. Practiced archery. I may be conflating stories as the tradition develops, you know. Maybe it was Bodhidharma who did this. In any case.
No, it was Koban.
So there was a gathering of a kind of exhibition of martial artists and, you know, great practitioners of power doing different amazing feats of discipline and control and, you know, slicing watermelons on top of disciples' heads without them falling down, that kind of thing. And, you know, all the pieces sting. This is my image of the event, you know, all these amazing feats happening. And then, or the way the story was told to me. And then it was Kobunchino's turn to, you know, I don't know, split another arrow with his arrow or do some amazing feat of archery. And I understood that this was at Esalen Institute, which is dramatic cliffs overlooking the ocean. And so he took everybody to the edge of the cliff and to, for his amazing feat of Zen archery and drew, you know, drew an arrow and fired it into the ocean. So
he hit the target.
He hit the target. Because you can't miss. This is not a matter of success and failure.
He supposedly said bullseye.
Bullseye. Exactly. You can see in each moment we could equally say, you know, success, or failure. Understanding that this is completely beyond success and failure. Who I am, what this is to be alive, when we say thusness or suchness, Buddha nature, or just life. I really like the word life. I'm not something on top of life, and nothing I do actually alienates me from life. Life never left. Life is who I am. And life is a knowable, changing question. However we can find our way in to this who is always the basis of success and failure, bigger than success and failure. And to kind of pitch our tent there, to ground our practice there, I find, again, isn't an excuse to then not take care of what I do or to let my mind go. On the contrary, taking care of, kind of abiding in this question or being open to this question or just living as closely as I can to who it is I am and the mystery of that and the perfection of that and the total inconceivability of that. That, I mean, according to Buddhism, that who it is that we are longs to do good. So to simply take care of that who, if I can kind of open some small channel for who I am, of course the channel is always fully, completely open. Because it's really just who we are now. Anyway, that this who we are affects then what we do. So it's not an excuse, it's an inspiration, and I think a way of holding the great weight of karma, the great weight of the consequence of our action, and the consequence of our attitudes of mind and heart, body. And I think as, you know, just as what will I do and how will I do it come to mind when we face impermanence, when we face death. Also, when we're really looking at death and change, even those things, you know, what I did, how I loved or something, how I was present, can't actually be the basis for judging a human life. So who it is, who we are. So I spoke a little longer than I intended to. I hope that made a little bit of sense. It's been on my mind for a long time and wanted to venture presenting it here with you today in this wonderful space. So if there are any questions or comments, I think we do have a few minutes left.
Yeah, we have some time. So, whoever, however, or whatever you would like to comment on or ask Jiryu, please feel free. Steve.
Yeah, I like to talk a lot. One thing I appreciated was it kind of took me back. There was a point in time when I was working with a teacher in Europe, and I had a horrible time with colleagues. It took me a long time to get anything. I kept looking for answers. One of the comments that was set out, or early ones, was from Basui. Who is it that hears? What is it that hears? And you can kind of go either way. And that's one that stays with me, not because there's an answer, because there really isn't. But that's a nice practice, to just sit with who is it that hears, or what is it that hears. It just leaves you in a space of maybe appreciating the mystery. And the practice you're talking about, or the how, the what, and who, that reminds me of it. It's just it's a really beautiful practice. So thank you for
thank you. Yeah. There's it's wonderful to ask the question who, and sometimes something responds. You know, who responds. And I think for me, one of the, and maybe as you're saying, to trying to find an answer, you know, or where I've gotten caught in that is imagining that this who, that there's, that there is some who, apart from this period, right? But apart from this, there's not a particular state of consciousness that is closer or farther from who. This again is why I so love the word life. Nothing I do gets me closer or farther from life. Sometimes I'm aware of something, and I would call it life in some kind of pure or beautiful or pristine form or something, but that's no closer or farther from life. It's like, you can't miss. So this, and I think practicing who really supports this, but for me it's this kind of faith, this deep reliance on not who as a matter of a state of consciousness that is pure being or something, but who is just like, it's okay, you know, or this is always, it's always who, it's always me, it's always this, it's always life, and I can't mess that one up, you know? Whereas when my experience of Goan is kind of messing it up, you know? And I think maybe succeeding in a Goan is realizing, actually, I can't mess this up, it really is just who I am. That's a real trap, I think, of Zen presentations on this wonderful who, it's that we must mean that we have it sometimes and don't some other time. If I get it right, I'll have it. He had it because he got it right.
Seems like, you know, there's a, I know what I want, it's a fixed answer.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, who now?
Yeah.
Who now? Kathy?
Thank you for your talk. I enjoyed it. It made me think about, especially your example in the beginning about the discipline and your counsel, you know, that who cares, in terms of, it made me think about behavior change in the field of mental health, you know, like when people are trying to stop smoking cigarettes or stop drinking or stop lots of things, you know, that what's been found is that one of the most important pieces is relapse prevention. You know, that you plan for relapse and that there's an attitude developed toward relapse that is one of acceptance and the ability to then move on and not get stuck in that, which typically leads to failure in terms of changing. And that a lot of people, when they change behaviors like that, have to go through a process of trying multiple times and I think observing their own process before they're able to kind of shift out of that behavior. So it seems to fit what you're talking about today. That sense of acceptance is so important of whatever's happening, even when we're trying to change something that's destructive to us, but just in general.
And does that... I think a fear is that kind of acceptance of failure or relapse would undermine the intensity of the effort, you know, or the understanding of how much is at stake. It's like because it's kind of paradoxical, right? Everything's at stake in this decision, and it's okay if I fail. It's hard. Do you find that actually those, you know, in a paradoxical way kind of support each other, or that the openness to relapse leads to a kind of, well, then whatever. Now she's saying it doesn't really matter if I get this or not, so then maybe it doesn't really matter. So then, hey, what the...
I don't deal with it all the time, but I think that people gradually... I think people often start out with that intense, I can't possibly fail, so, it's not okay. And they get more stuck and rigid, and that over time, you know, maybe we wear ourselves down or we realize it isn't working, or... there's a shift gradually of whatever, you know, let's move on.
I like the way you talk about failure and the renewal of vows and resolutions, but as it happens all the time in our practice, even just sitting zazen, right? I mean, becoming distracted is very tempting to think of that as a failure, and then coming back to the breath and waking up as some sort of success, and yet it's just, that can't be it, right? Especially since when you pop back awake, it's not like you were awake and reminded yourself to get awake. It just happens, and you're sitting here. It's more. It seems like it's more renewal. Okay, I'm going to sit here. Okay, sit up straight and live this, whatever it is. And it seems like a lot in our life is that renewal of vows and renewal of resolution. I mean, you're not going to. It's not going to be perfect, but we keep trying. We keep this aim in mind, and remember that from time to time.
Yeah, this in zazen for me, this like I never really left, you know. I know I left, and now I'm happy that I'm back. You know, a little ding, like constant. But to not, you know, to enjoy that, but to not believe it, you know, to not believe that I really wasn't there, you know, that didn't count, that wasn't life, that was less than. So a saint is not better if we can really believe this for ourselves, you know, understand that a saint is not better than a thief, you know, and understand that in ourselves. Fundamentally, you know, I think it's kind of easy to kind of make yourself think that externally, you know, but to think that about ourselves, I'm not better when I succeed and worse when I fail. And yet, I want to try again. No, I want to keep coming. Thank you.
Libby.
What happened for me in the course of your talk was that in the beginning, when you were using the language of success and failure, you could kind of sense that there was something, off about success, the very concept of it. And then, but as the talk progressed, it felt like the concepts sort of fell away more. Like when you went to the how, it was like this relief of, oh, right, you just find that way of being that it's not really about, but then you uncovered, there is still embedded in there some sense of, but you could fail at being that way. And so then when you went to the who, it just dissolved altogether. It's like those terms became irrelevant. It was just that. So it's not, so for me, you were saying about the danger of then, elevating that question, oh, right, I should always be in that free space where I'm not so caught in success and failure. It's not to elevate that, but it's just to, I guess what I got from the talk was sort of just every time I can ask myself that question, every time I can remind, just to, be anxious again. I understand that way.
Yeah, for me, it's like the tension vanishes, but the energy is still there, which is it's critical to me. Thanks. Interesting.
I had a question. You were talking earlier about just being feeling immature as a 6-year-old, and that things don't really matter. But then you gave that example of the archer shooting the arrow off in the ocean. In a way, when we were talking about that, just his actions kind of struck me as immature, and I wasn't sure if I was reading that right. It seemed like his running off, he was very proficient martial artist, and he's just kind of like, well, I'm shooting here over the ocean. And but that's interesting.
Then, as soon as you. My understanding of kind of Zen speak or Zen tradition is that it's always just untangling. Someone says something just to untangle the thing that the last person said, or even or the thing that they just said. So it's true. Like Koban has now made a grave error, and it's our responsibility as actually living people now to point that out and take our stand against Koban's grave error. and then hope that somebody comes along and corrects our error. So I think that that's true, that with all these stories you can imagine people just do mean stuff or do immature stuff, but it only works if it's correcting something. And I guess that teaching for me did correct that I thought he should hit it, but now if I think it doesn't matter, then if there's Zen people around, hopefully they'll do the next turning, the turning of it. So, but yeah, it's not a landing place. I really appreciate that openness can just become another immaturity. Thank you.
Time for one last Keizo.
Thank you for your talk. You used the word spiritual a couple times in your talk, and it sounded really nice. But I've been kind of. I'm in the process of doing some job applications as a college professor. And, I spent a good portion of my adult life pursuing this spiritual thing. So, I'm kind of engaged in how do I present myself. And that word has been striking me as particularly problematic in a way. Like, it sounds really good in here, but it may be some other place. It doesn't sound so good, or it's not so useful, or something. Mm-hmm. So anyway, generally the word spiritual, I've become really skeptical of it. But then again, I'm skeptical of the word Zen too. So maybe I was just hoping you could speak to your own perspective on this. spiritual issue?
My own skepticism. Spiritual as opposed to grounded, or spiritual as opposed to intellectual, or spiritual as opposed to serious. You know, it does depend on the context. Or spiritual as opposed to deluded. You know, so what's the context? I think just what I've found, my particular Zen training is kind of, it's the style, but it's strange, you know? It's basically you do kind of, in my practice has been to do basically kind of like monastic style training with people who really are on the same page, using the same language, thinking the same little stuff is super important. And then one day you're told to start giving talks to people who maybe don't think those little things are, or don't even know what you're talking about, you know, or think that that's important, or assume that that's important, or assume that, you know, leaping beyond even the Buddha way is like what we're all here for, you know. I was like, so I think as I've had more opportunity to speak, I've noticed my tendency to talk like in Buddhist, you know, in Buddhism or as Buddhism, as though I can use terms like the Great Way or something and that people know what I'm talking about or relate to it. And I sometimes feel like, you know, people aren't, like, this means something to me very concrete, but it's not touching, you know. Spiritual seems like a shared, a way in, you know, something shared that's a little bit bigger than the language that I've learned to talk about these kinds of issues. But yeah, spirit, I hope that you can find a better word. There is, you know, I think for me, initially I was initially drawn to spiritual practice, and I understood it as unembodied. And so part of, for me, the kind of magic of hitting Zen was to find that spiritual, that a spiritual life was completely embodied, completely grounded, was really important to me, having done spiritual stuff for spiritual head trips, basically. As opposed to like spiritual body, you know, so that spiritual practice is the body, is kind of, yeah, then is it spiritual? And what do you, yeah. So yeah, thank you for problematizing that. Now I would be more,
you'll be more spiritual?
No, no, I'll be more concerned about how I can't say it a great way, but I can't say spiritual.
Well, I said it sounded good.
Yeah, maybe it's to use it moderately in moderation.
Well, I've heard it said about Zen that anything you say misses the mark. Mark, but I enjoyed your talk anyway.
Thank you
very much. Thank you very much.